Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the USA Freedom Act, a watered-down NSA surveillance reform bill that passed the House last Thursday by 303 to 121 votes. Shahid Bhattar, the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the People's Campaign for the Constitution, joins us to discuss the gutting of the first legislation aimed at curbing the abuses that Edward Snowden revealed through last-minute language inserted by intelligence community loyalists. We will also look into the disappointment expressed by Senator Leahy, whose much stronger Senate bill will be considered next month. Then we'll speak with Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and the author of a new book, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. He joins us to discuss the growing irrelevance of U.S. policies and attitudes in the region that are tied to reactionary regimes like Saudi Arabia, while Turkey's Muslim model of dynamic and effective democratic governance is all but ignored in a region where the Arab world is adrift and where conventional U.S.-centric analysis does not reflect the Middle East's own history and culture. Then finally, Francis Kissling, the former president of Catholics for Choice, who is a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, joins us to discuss restrictive new anti-abortion laws passed last week in Louisiana that add to Alabama's, Mississippi's, and Texas's efforts to outlaw abortion by forcing abortion clinics out of business through the imposition of onerous medical burdens on their clinics. We will discuss the growing red and blue state divide in America and the prospect of millions of women taking buses north for procedures that are legal in the nation but unattainable in the South. And joining us now is Shahid Bhattar, who is the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the People's Campaign for the Constitution. Previously, he was Director of a national program to combat racial and religious profiling by federal authorities, an Associate Director of the American Constitution Society, and a public interest litigator in private practice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shahid Bhattar.
Thanks so much for having me on, Ian.
And the NSA Surveillance Reform Bill, as it's called, the USA Freedom Act, passed the House by 303 votes to 121 a few days ago. And it looks as though this is the worst kind of reform, isn't it? Where you have the appearance of reform, but apart from the fact that they've are not going to collect metadata anymore, at least as they used to, but essentially it doesn't really seem to, from what I can tell, and maybe there's more to be learned, this really hasn't addressed any of the issues that have been raised since Edward Snowden brought them to light.
You're exactly right. The original version of the USA Freedom Act would have imposed quite meaningful reforms on government surveillance run amok. Unfortunately, the version of the USA Freedom Act that emerged from the House is a pale shadow of its original self. And not only would the bill as revised not only fail to curtail NSA surveillance, but there are a number of ways in which it could actually make it worse. And it's worth noting, for instance, that the bill extends the Patriot Act and the sunsets on it for 2 years. It, while making very meager changes to Section 215 of the Patriot Act, that's the provision that enables the telephony metadata surveillance, it does essentially nothing to curtail Internet surveillance under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And that under-inclusion renders the bill, as it was ultimately passed by the House, very problematic and even potentially counterproductive.
So the people who brought it forth, Sensenbrenner and Justin Amash, who originally, remember just shortly after this, these revelations happened, Justin Amash put up a bill that failed by 205 to 217 votes. And that shocked the intelligence community because it came so close.
Big deal. I mean, his bill would have defunded the NSA domestic dragnet. It was a huge surprise to the intelligence establishment that so groundbreaking a bill would come so close to passage.
So what happened to his constituency? Did they just get worn down? Or, I mean, we know the bill was watered down, but how did the intelligence community get somehow dampen all that passion? And, I mean, let's face it, a lot of people didn't vote for it, 121, and 303 voted for it. So there are a lot of people who know that they got had and didn't vote for it. I'm not sure where. Do you know how Amash voted on this?
I don't know how he particularly voted, but the original sponsors of the USA Freedom Act in the House were James Sensenbrenner, the Republican on the Judiciary Committee, and John Conyers, who is the former chair of that committee, a Democrat. And it was a bipartisan initiative, also led in the Senate by Patrick Leahy. And I think the key piece to think about with respect to the USA Freedom Act is the co-optation of meaningful reforms by the intelligence agencies and the executive branch, notwithstanding a bipartisan consensus across two different congressional committees. When the House Judiciary Committee approved the USA Freedom Act, it did it unanimously. And when the Intelligence Committee reviewed its bill to restrain NSA surveillance, it basically, on the hearing that it was scheduled to look at its bill, it instead looked at the USA Freedom Act. And what the House voted on this week was not the result of that process, but rather the co-opted result of a backdoor process where the White House, in collaboration with the House leadership, gutted that bill and instead presented to the House a co-opted version of NSA reform that is ultimately as enabling as it is reforming. And so you're absolutely right to note how it is a vast disappointment relative to the initial expectation. The two things I'd say there is, A, the battle now moves to the Senate, where a stronger version of the original bill still survives, and B, you know, even if the strongest version of the USA Freedom Act passed, there would still be more to do to rein in the NSA's dragnet. Congress has a lot of work to do to unwind the last 12 years, and unfortunately, it's just getting started.
So do you think that some of the people who defected and voted against it because they thought it was too watered down, I mean, the two people that sponsored the bill, Republican Jim Sensenbrenner and Democrat John Conyers, both backed the bill, but influential Republicans like Darrell Issa, Ted Poe, and Raul Labrador, and Democrat Zoe Lofgren and Adam Smith, the most senior Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, they all voted against the bill. They felt
right. Amash did too. I checked since you asked. He also voted against
it. Yeah, I would have thought so, yeah. And Zoe Lofgren said, "Regrettably, we have learned that the intelligence community will run a truck through ambiguity." So
she's right. I mean, the provision of the Patriot Act that was at issue with most of the provisions of the USA Freedom Act, that's Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which enables the surveillance of telephony metadata, basically tapping the back end of the phone system. That provision itself has been the subject of a secret government interpretation that for years members of Congress would say or have said would outrage the American people if it were public. And, of course, it took 12 years and Edward Snowden to make public even just a little bit of what is happening, and we still don't know. Congress also still does not know the full extent of the NSA's assault on the American people, and as long as it continues to legislate in the dark, it is entirely predictable that the meager attempts that Congress makes to place the genie of domestic surveillance back in the bottle will leave cards on the table. And at the very least, Congress has to finally, for the first time in 40 years, actually investigate the intelligence agencies, and it hasn't done it. And until that happens, everything we talk about will unfortunately start from the position of not completing the job.
Again, I'm speaking with Shahid Bhattar, who is the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the People's Campaign for the Constitution. Previously, he was Director of a National Program to Combat Racial and Religious Profiling by Federal Authorities, an Associate Director of the American Constitution Society, and a public interest litigator in private practice. So the mood on Capitol Hill, and certainly it's reflected in the White House, has been fairly much about the idea that American secrecy, if you will, is leaking like a sieve, and Snowden is the poster boy for that, and that we've got to tighten up the rules, and we've particularly got to make examples of people like James Risen of the New York Times. That seems to be the mood. Now, you know, it's a folly and a massive mistake in terms of the First Amendment to go after reporters for doing their job if the intelligence community can't keep its own secrets. So isn't there a lot of scapegoating going on here?
Absolutely, there's a lot of scapegoating going on here. You know, apparently there was a FOIA request that today unleashed or revealed part of a Defense Department analysis that aimed to document and explain the damage on our foreign policy interests that the Snowden revelations supposedly wrought. And, you know, there is so much self-dealing here that when called on the carpet by members of Congress, to admit essentially their constitutional crimes, executive officials across each of the last two administrations have flat out lied to Congress. And I don't think there is a worse crime in a democracy than lying to the body, the people's representatives in Washington, the people who write the checks for these executive programs, when they do the rare, when, as they rarely do, they actually perform their jobs and ask the tough questions, and the executive branch lies and gets away with it. I think that that indicates and reflects exactly that kind of, I dare say, institutional corruption that you're describing, and it's unfortunately pervasive across the intelligence agencies.
But it seems to be driven by an attitude that's coming from the White House and from Obama, that somehow the press is being irresponsible, and they have to be made an example of in the case of James Risen. It's likely that that he's going to lose at the Supreme Court, or they're going to throw it back, which will mean that he'll go to jail, isn't it?
Well, and expand the context, you're absolutely right that, for instance, the Justice Department was caught tapping the phones of Associated Press journalists just about a year ago. In fact, the preceding news cycle before the Snowden revelations was about the assault on the press. The only place where I guess I would differ with you is to say that, to the extent it's emerging from the White House, I wouldn't locate it exclusively at President Obama's feet. I think this is just what presidents do, regardless of who the president is, right? And I think one of the things we can learn from the Obama administration and its unfortunate failure to effectuate its campaign mandate is the co-optation of any chief executive in the service of the enlargement of executive power. We can't actually vote away these powers, right? If the courts aren't independent and Congress is co-opted and beholden to corporations, and the White House can't be trusted to actually defend the interests of the American people because it has its own interests, which occupy whomever comes into that office, what it really suggests is the need to shift the landscape, as our nation has done many times before on any number of issues, ranging from women's suffrage to environmental regulation or civil rights, right? That it is grassroots movements that determine the terms of debate in our country. And we are in desperate need of one to grow louder than it has to this point in challenging the emergence of the imperial presidency.
Well, I suppose, for, you know, when you say presidents get co-opted, there's no question about it that, you know, the massive power of the office, particularly during the Cold War, where you could literally press a button and destroy the world, and that reminder is always there. You know, the football, the guy with the nuclear code still wanders around behind the president. But that notwithstanding, I understand why presidents, even those that wanted to destroy the CIA, like Jack Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs debacle, and Jimmy Carter, who ran against the CIA and the abuses during the Church Committee hearings, they all turn around and use it with a vengeance because it's the favorite tool of the executive branch. So I suspect that what happens to all presidents is they get sort of bonded with the intelligence agencies, they rely on them. And in Obama's case, I think he's haunted by the idea that if there's another terrorist attack on the United States, his presidency is over or the country will go crazy again. Do you buy into that notion? I'm not trying to make excuses for him, but I'm just trying to understand his mentality.
I do tend to think that's right, and I think I'd reflect on it in two different dimensions. The first is that, to whatever extent officials in the Obama administration and perhaps the president himself want their legacy not to be some catastrophic attack on the United States, the alternative danger, and the one that I think that they have gone beyond risking and have now solidified and secured, is that his legacy, the legacy of this administration, will be the entrenchment of the Bush administration's legacy and the bipartisan entrenchment of the imperial presidency to the derogation of the constitutional design that our nation was once very proud to have pioneered and introduced to the world. That's the first issue. The second is that I think it is absolutely inescapable. It is demonstrably true that presidents react based on who is whispering in their ears. And for better or worse, the figures that whisper most in the president's ears come from three-letter agencies that are unaccountable to the public, whose histories are pervaded by severe failures, who hide their crimes from Congress and the public, and you know, many of them continue to conduct the very same assaults on the American people that they were under the prior administration. And, of course, it was this president's repudiation of those abuses that got him into office. And yet now he's, you know, essentially driven by the same agencies. I think no issue illustrates this in sharper relief, in my mind, than the extrajudicial assassination regime, right? under the Obama administration, an entirely new class of human rights abuses has emerged in the form of robotic remote assassination. And it was just this week, in fact, an Obama administration senior lawyer from the Office of Legal Counsel was considered by the Senate for a judicial appointment, despite having signed away a right that had stood for 800 years. And not since the Magna Carta has a government claiming itself to be a democracy asserted the right to kill its citizens without any evidence of crime. And that power is now well established in the United States, and the figure who established it seems to be well on their way to becoming a lifetime federal appellate judge. And I think it's appalling, quite frankly.
Well, you know, going back to the Founding Fathers, it was, of course, Benjamin Franklin that said, he who would trade liberty for temporary security deserves neither. And that clearly is a message that has been lost over the ages. But when you were saying earlier, Shahid Bhattar, that there is some hope here that the Senate bill will be tougher. On last Thursday, Senator Leahy issued a statement expressing disappointment in this House bill that we're talking about here, the USA Freedom Act. He said, just to quote what he said last Thursday, is, "Today's action in the House continues the bipartisan effort to restore America's civil liberties. But I was disappointed that the legislation passed today does not include some of the meaningful reforms contained in the original USA Freedom Act. I will continue to push for these important reforms when the Senate Judiciary Committee considers the USA Freedom Act next month." So this would seem to me to be a time for people to get behind the Senate bill, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And I want to say two things about the Senate bill. The first is that it will likely be stronger than the House bill, at least to the extent that it is currently still the original version of the bill, which is much stronger than it was after being watered down, not just once in the House, but twice. Once as it went through committees, and then a second time in secret by the White House after it had passed the committees. The Senate bill is starting out from a much stronger place. Wherever it ends up, it will then have to be reconciled with the House bill. And so that's the first point of slippage, is that whatever emerges from the Senate could well be essentially eroded to meet the least common denominator of what has already passed through the House. Beyond this USA Freedom Act, however, is a further opportunity for Congress to do something meaningful. There's a bill, the Surveillance State Repeal Act, which would actually complete the job of unwinding the Bush administration's legacy with respect to dragnet mass surveillance. It has not attracted nearly as much support from members of Congress, and many members of Congress who are willing to talk a big game about privacy have yet to assertively pick up, champion, and take ownership of the one reform package among the 25 that have been introduced in Congress that would actually force the intelligence agencies to justify the post-9/11 expansion of their powers from a pre-9/11 baseline. And that's exactly what Congress should do, is require the agencies to do exactly that. And only the Surveillance State Repeal Act would do it. And you know, it's not even on the agenda yet. So whatever happens with the USA Freedom Act, Congress will have more to do. It is now, after a year of the Snowden revelations, is Congress even beginning to take the first meager baby steps toward reform, and it has a lot of work remaining.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Shahid Bhattar.
Thanks so much for having me on, Ian. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Shahid Bhattar, who is the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and the People's Campaign for the Constitution. Previously, he was Director of a National Program to Combat Racial and Religious Profiling by Federal Authorities, an Associate Director of the American Constitutional Society, and a public interest litigator in private practice. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about America's growing irrelevance in the Middle East.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam. And his latest book just out is Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
And Erdogan, the Prime Minister of Turkey, has had a bad year. I mean, your book suggests that the importance of Turkey in the Middle East, but just in terms of his political fortunes, he seems to have had a bad year, and he seems to dig the hole deeper every time there's a protest like there was in Gezi Park and more recently with the mining disaster. Could you make the case that his Islamist Party of Justice and Development is pretty heavy on the development side, but doesn't seem to have much of a grasp on justice?
Well, you know, Ian, I think we're looking, first of all, at a remarkable run of the AKP party, as it calls itself, the Turkish initials, the Justice and Development Party, AKP, in Turkey. This party, since coming to power 11, 12 years ago, has really transformed Turkey in amazing respects, politically, economically, militarily, culturally, religiously, and had undertaken a major revolution in their entire approach to foreign policy in the region and in the world. So the book has a lot of praise and indeed goes into some considerable detail as to why these accomplishments of the AKP party in power have been truly remarkable and innovative, game-changing, and I argue largely irreversible. Now, what is unfortunate is that Erdogan, who's the prime minister and architect, primary architect of most of this, I think after, you know, over a decade in power, is beginning to lose his touch. We see this in party after party, no matter how good, you know, Margaret Thatcher lost it towards the end. It's sad, it's unfortunate, but I really wonder whether he is going to be able to regain his balance and not destroy, that's the most dismaying thing of all, not destroy the remarkable legacy of that decade. So I think the book properly focuses on that rather than the decline. Declines are never pretty anywhere. But I think that decade is what the book is about and what's so important and not canceled out by an unhappy ending.
Well, this unhappy year that he's had, and certainly in terms of an ending, it's not that way in electoral politics. His party just won handsomely. So what we're seeing in the press doesn't reflect the Turkish people's attitude. He may be losing his luster in the West, but he doesn't seem to be losing that much luster at home, is he?
Well, you remember, I mean, he has, according to Turkish political system, he has won very successfully, but this doesn't mean it's ever been a majoritarian party as such. So he has declined some, and the last election, furthermore, was not about parliament or presidents, but it was about mayoral, local, municipal elections, which you can argue may have been a referendum on Erdogan's decade in power, but it also had to do with what people thought about local candidates. So I think much more important is going to be the coming election for president this August, in which Erdogan himself is running. And you're absolutely right, Ian. I mean, people are aware now of the corruption that's coming to light. Not surprising after a party in power for so long. But there are no other really serious candidates out there. Well, I think people just don't feel, given all the successes of the decade, that they want to change horses. They may hold their nose and vote for him again for lack of anybody better. But those changes that he's introduced in every area are permanent and powerful and important to the region and to the West.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest book just out is Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. So let's talk about Turkey and the Arab Spring. I mean, first of all, just in a broader sense, the last time we had stability in the Middle East was when there was a Turkish Empire, right? And ever since 1916 or 1917 or thereabouts, it's been a chaos. What's your reading on the Arab Spring, which most people are declaring dead?
Well, I think dead is probably not the word. I think it's been suppressed and is sort of gone underground. But when people rise up across the region and bring change, even if that change has not proven successful and or is suppressed, the memory doesn't go away. The region has moved forward in the experience of a younger generation that knows that they can, in fact, change things, but they've got to learn how to do it better. So I'm positive in the sense that I think some good things have come out of it. But in the end, you know, the Arab world started out pretty dead in the water in terms of international power, influence, or prestige, and run by leaders that had no respect on the part of any of the peoples. They're dictators. They're often fulfilling policies that Washington has prescribed rather than what the people in the country want. So I think it's a time of reckoning, but Turkey came out largely in the Arab Spring immediately in favor of every one of these revolutions. And I think it was a pretty good guess in most of the cases. Where they failed was in guessing wrong about this total mess in Syria and the kind of uprising against the Assad regime. To put it in perspective, no country got this right. The U.S. has been thrashing around, Europe has been thrashing around, Turks, Russians, you know, the whole world. So everybody, the Turks thought, here we go again, another revolution, we'll back this. But in the end, it did not work for anybody. And I think the world has now decided that Assad, as bad as he is better than alternative, possible alternatives. But Turkey will be a major player in any future Syria, probably the number one important player.
Well, of course, Erdogan turned against Assad, who previously had good relations with him, declared him dead prematurely, as did Hillary Clinton. And as you point out, it's a total mess there. But he has supported the Muslim Brotherhood element, which was the biggest opposition element. And it seems like the Saudis have let in and others have let in all of the jihadists who are basically a gift to Assad. But what is the intent when you say, for example, he supports revolution or the Erdogan and his party supports revolution? They support the Muslim Brotherhood. They've also just lost out in Egypt. I was speaking yesterday with a specialist on Libya who was pointing out that this new warlord general is trying to put together a national army to fight the Islamists, is complaining that the West sort of bombed Gaddafi out of business and left the rubble behind, left behind no army, no police. The vacuum was filled by Islamists, and the people who've been funding and supplying the Islamists have been Turkey and Qatar, both of whom are, well, Turkey's certainly an ally through NATO, and Qatar is an ally of sorts. So what's the sense of that? Why?
Well, first of all, you know we've talked about this in earlier programs. You know that Islamists represent a very broad spectrum from sure. violent to peaceful and radical and more moderate. So what Turkey does believe is that the Muslim Brotherhood, which across a spectrum, a Islamist spectrum in the region, is on the moderate side. I mean, that does support democratic principles in general. I'm not saying they do it well, but they have accepted the idea. I think Turkey and Qatar both believe that the Muslim Brotherhood believe two things. First, that Islam as a political force is far from dead in the region. Indeed, it's the source from which political ideas have sprung for 1,500 years. It's evolving for sure, but we cannot expect that suddenly tomorrow everybody's going to download the American or French Constitution and apply it locally. Islamic thinking, political thinking, will be a powerful force, whether the Islamists are suppressed for the moment in Egypt. They're not gone. The ideas are not gone. So Turkey and Qatar, interestingly, both believe that the Muslim Brotherhood does have a future in general in the region, or something like the Muslim Brotherhood. It should not be suppressed. It should be given a chance to develop. It should be also given a chance to fail. That was one of the biggest things I think about Egypt, was that the Brotherhood had a chance. They seemingly were not doing very well, flailing around, but nobody else was particularly doing very well either. But I would like to have seen them fail and fail at the ballot box in the next year. But they were pulled out, so nobody knows now how they would have worked out, and they can claim they were robbed. But anyway, so we have Turkey here, which stands basically in the region for democracy, for putting the military back into the barracks, for a globalized economy, for a moderate application of religion to political principles, and believe in policies that reflect the view of the people in the region and not something that is Washington's preference. So in this respect, Turkey is the absolute opposite of everything that Saudi Arabia stands for, which is no democracy, no globalization, don't open up the country, support hardline Salafi Wahhabis as opposed to moderate future political Islam. That, to me, is the real polarization, the polarity of the future Middle East, and not Sunni versus Shia, or, you know, jihadists versus liberals. It's basically about liberal or ultra-conservative oppressive views of Islamic politics.
And of course, it's no accident that Saudi Arabia have supported the coup against the Muslim Brotherhood and are financing the Egyptian military government that is somewhat isolated. They, of course, the fact that we support Saudi Arabia unconditionally, even though they have spread a violent and xenophobic form of Islam around the world, in particular in Pakistan and certainly the Taliban, they've had their effect all across Africa and now in Egypt. And clearly, they don't want democracy or even any semblance of it. This is a medieval monarchy that doesn't. The only political activity is the largesse of the king. There's nothing else. And why do you think that we aren't really embracing Turkey as a champion of democracy, since we here in the United States are supposedly the champions of democracy?
Well, I mean, we have sort of supported Turkey in a number of respects, but you have to remember that Turkey really cut itself away, cut its ties with the United States when the AKP party came to power. I don't mean rejecting the United States at all, but simply saying, look, the policies that you've perceived, they haven't said it quite this bluntly, but I'm saying really what it was. They've said pretty much your policies in the region have been disastrous, have failed, and have exacerbated the problem with every single one of our neighbors and in our region. So we don't want to go the route of American policies in the region or support them. So that for that reason, they didn't even allow the United States to invade Iraq from Turkish soil. As you know, they refused to do that. So I think Turkey really is pursuing policies that, from my perspective, are basically wiser in regional terms, closer to reality, understanding reality, more than Washington by a long shot. And that makes Washington very uncomfortable, because it's essentially the American agenda, obviously, that Washington would like to pursue. But I don't think that's what anyone in the region wants, and that's why I think the United States is falling behind and increasingly irrelevant, if not angering, to most of the peoples in the region.
But if as you say, Graham Fuller, the real divide is not Sunni versus Shia, but modernizers and democratizers versus reactionaries like the Saudi kingdom, you know, the extent to which they've been duplicitous towards us in creating the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda came out of Saudi Arabia, and they've helped destabilize Pakistan, etc. At what point will we acknowledge that uncomfortable, somewhat, you know, I think unhealthy relationship with Saudi Arabia? Or are we just so simply tied to oil? And of course, now that we may want to try and punish Putin if he does any more, misbehaves any more, we'd need the Saudis to pump extra oil to hurt Putin, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the day, have we sold our soul for Saudi crude?
I think yes, particularly in the old, going back to the old days, both the oil and economic power of Saudi Arabia, and by economic power, I mean what they can do with all their huge oil revenues and buy American weapons and stand on the American side of policies that are not popular to the people of the region. Yeah, I think we had sold ourselves or bought in, let's say, very heavily into the Saudi view. That's probably less true now, but still we're kind of stuck with it. I think the world has changed. Oil is a global commodity, so it doesn't really matter whether we buy our oil from Saudi Arabia or from somewhere else. It's part of this global pool. But I think just by default, we feel that the Gulf, we're the guardians of the Gulf and protectors of the Gulf, when that just really isn't quite true anymore. The Chinese and the Indians and the Japanese are the major consumers of this oil. It's flowing east and not west. They're the ones concerned about tankers and sea lanes. So I suspect that our role in the Persian Gulf or Arab Gulf, whatever you want to call it, is dwindling in importance. And a whole new constellation of international policies are emerging in the region with China and India and Russia and others. I think Obama shows some signs of this, in that he now sees that he can't call the shots as much as he might like to. I think neocons are just beside themselves. You know, why are we not asserting our power? But obviously our efforts to assert our power have been utterly disastrous, losing and exacerbating the situation. So Obama, in this, I think, at least sees now that we've got to back off a little from this idea that we can run it all and run it successfully.
Well, just in closing, Graham Fuller, your new book, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, has been number one on Amazon in the category of Middle East politics. And as you pointed out, the book really does explain what's happening in the Middle East, not in American terms or America-centric terms, but in terms of the reality on the ground. Do you think that that's why your book is taking off?
I think it might be one of the reasons, because there are lots of people from the Middle East, both Turks and Arabs and even Iranians, especially those living in the United States, who I think do feel a sense of frustration that so much of American media do not reflect regional realities, but rather the world that we'd like it to be or hope it will be, or various ideological blinders, and that it tend to ignore. I mean, you know, it's all through the eyes of that American power essentially creates the realities in the Middle East. I think Cheney said as much some years ago, but that's not the way the people of the region see it. The dynamics are quite different, and I think they are rather excited about a book that really reflects what they see as their own reality, and I hope it's the reality that Washington will increasingly understand and buy into.
Well, we are certainly fickle. I mean, I recall the enormous American enthusiasm about what happened in Tahrir Square and the revolution or the uprising against Mubarak, and now we all but have forgotten. We're ignoring the current situation. So when it's happening the way we like it, we're all enthusiastic. But when it gets real, we kind of back away.
Yes, sadly, that's the case. I think slowly we may be learning, because we can't afford to go on the way we've done it in through loss of blood and treasure and anger created in the region. So I'm mildly optimistic that even though we may be slow learners, we may be learning.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest book just out is Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how legal abortions are being shut down in the South. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is feminist activist Frances Kissling, who was the president for Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007. She's now on the faculty of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. She's a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, where she works on reproductive health in Latin America and writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs at Religion Dispatch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Kissling.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And the South is becoming by closing down abortion clinics throughout the South, and now the Louisiana State Legislature on Wednesday passed a bill that would force three of the state's five abortion clinics to close. And this is following similar bills passed in Alabama and also in Mississippi and Texas. So it does seem that the people who are trying to make abortion illegal by simply making it unavailable seem to be on a roll in the South.
Yes, definitely. And I would say beyond the South, although I just do have to say, given my past history with Catholics for Choice, that it seems that Southerners and Catholics are now vying for who is more retrograde on women's health and women's rights. But that aside, the situation is really becoming quite dire. We're now at a point where more than 15 states have passed these laws requiring doctors to have admitting privileges at local hospitals, and more than half of the states have laws regarding the condition, the standards of freestanding abortion facilities, really bringing them up to a level comparable to that of almost a hospital, and thus again making abortion making abortion then much more difficult for women to get. This is a very troubling trend.
But it seems to be a device to pretend that you're trying to increase the medical equipment and level of medical care on abortions because you really care about women, when in fact you're just making it impossible for the current abortion providers to stay in business.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. Neither these laws that require physicians to have privileges at a local hospital, nor these, nor the size of your storage room, that kind of facilities stuff that's going on, make abortion one whit safer. They make abortion more dangerous because they will cause the closing down of good clinics all over the country, which they are already doing, which means that women will have a harder time finding a provider. They will be forced to wait till later in their pregnancy when abortion does become more complicated and might have greater complications. And in many cases, they won't get abortions at all. It has nothing to do with safety. It has everything to do with preventing abortions from happening.
So are we going to have a situation now where women, and either young women or married women who simply can't afford to have another child, have to get on Greyhound buses and go hundreds of miles to...
Yes, I think it will be. I mean, I started in the abortion field in 1970 when the law changed in New York, and also it had changed in California at the same time. And when I would arrive at work in the morning at the local clinic where I worked, there would be cars in the parking lot, you know, old automobiles from Kentucky, Ohio, Alabama, often with young kids, boyfriends and girlfriends, who drove all night to come to New York to get an abortion, a kind of stress that they certainly did not need at a difficult time like this.
So how have they gotten away with this? I mean, I know that it's all done in the names of caring about life and caring about women, but the whole process has been so patently dishonest. You know, they're not really, they claim to care about women, but they're really on this absolute obsession to get rid of abortion, and they found a way to do it through the back door without saying it's really about their true intentions. I mean, I'd respect these people more if they were really just upfront about what their intentions are, that we just want to ban abortion outright, and if the Supreme Court won't go along with us, then we'll shut down every clinic in the country. At least I'd have some respect for them if they said that outright.
Yeah, and a few of them have. Some of the quotes from the Louisiana situation from the anti-abortion groups down there said, this is our incremental strategy to getting abortion closed down. But the reason that they get away with it, there are two reasons that I think they get away with it. One is that even though it's half of the states who have passed laws like this, and many of them are in the South, the reason that they get away with that is because we have very conservative state legislatures. That's the first reason. The second reason that they get away with it, and I've been thinking about this a lot, is to me even more important. It is the complicity of hospitals in these efforts. Why are those hospitals not giving doctors privileges? And why are we tolerating, allowing hospitals to deny privileges to doctors? I mean, we shouldn't have to do this, but these laws shouldn't exist. But since these laws are going to exist, then we really need to deal with the very sorry state of support for legal abortion in this nation's hospitals. First, the fact that the hospitals do not give privileges to doctors who are performing abortions. Sometimes because the doctors are from far distances, and sometimes just because they don't want to. Secondly, you know, there are 5,000 community hospitals in the United States, and there are only 592 hospitals that report providing any abortions in the course of a year, and 400 of those provide less than 30 abortions a year. This situation vis-a-vis hospitals is something that those of us who are pro-choice need to start paying attention to.
Again, I'm speaking with feminist activist Frances Kissling, who was president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007. She's currently on the faculty of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. She's a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, where she works on reproductive health in Latin America and writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs at religiondispatches.org. So the point that you made about the hospitals is I think, very key, because that would solve the problem overnight. But is it just the case that, you know, Catholic hospitals aside, that these people don't want the trouble? Because the problem with these anti-abortion people is that they're quite zealous, and they've been picketing abortion clinics for a long time. And I imagine hospitals just don't want people outside picketing.
Yeah, nobody wants people outside picketing. Let's be clear about that. And I think that that certainly is one of the factors that influences hospitals in their decisions to provide abortion services or not provide abortion services. It's also the degree to which abortion is, and abortion and physicians who perform abortion have been stigmatized also contributes to this. You just don't want it in your hospital. You don't want to become known as the abortion hospital. It is also more expensive to provide abortion services in a hospital. We shouldn't have to provide abortion services in a hospital. We should be able to provide them in freestanding clinics. But as you know, but since this is the trend and is going to continue this way, and we are going to see more laws requiring that clinics mimic the facilities of hospitals and doctors without privileges, then we really do, as a movement, need to look at working with hospitals and finding ways to get them to step up to the plate. We might find that picketing in front of hospitals is more difficult, that there might be more sympathy if you start to get a lot of, let's get a lot of pickets going to hospitals, and let's see how the local police and local authorities handle that. That might not have quite the same popularity, or at least the same acceptance as some of the picketing at clinics does. So I think that hospitals need to be called to accountability. They are healthcare facilities. They say they are there for women. Many of them have women's health units, and yet they will not do a single abortion. This is simply unacceptable.
Well, you know, this bill is obviously going to be signed. It's passed out of the legislature on Wednesday by a vote of 88-5, and it'll be on Governor Bobby Jindal's desk, and he's already called this bill a common sense bill that gives women the health and safety protections they deserve. Now, this is a guy that is perennially trying to run for president, he just is something of a joke on television. But he has presidential ambitions. Is there any way for people to come down on him? I mean, the idea that he's touting that line that this is about women's health and safety is just so hollow that it's,
I think that clearly people who are working on the abortion issue from a pro-choice perspective make the point over and over again that these policies do not increase safety for women. The arguments I made at the beginning of our segment, that in fact they have the potential of creating more complications than we currently have, and the complications rates are very low. I just think that people like Bobby Jindal do not care about the truth. And, the solution, of course, is ultimately you have to get these people out of office.
Well, I was just wondering if there's a... Why is it that a minority movement is so successful and so strategic and can thwart the will of the majority? Because polls indicate that the will of the majority in this country is that Roe v. Wade is constitutional, that the Supreme Court has held that position for a long time. So I'm just curious to know why the majority is at a strategic deficit here, or a tactical deficit.
Well, first of all, the majority is a national majority, which differs from state to state. So in that sense, these people are not trying to pass these laws in New York, you know?
Right.
They're not trying to pass this law in Illinois. They're passing these laws with a very smart legislative strategy in states where governors and legislatures will pass them. That's the first thing. The second thing is when you really take a close look at public opinion on abortion, in general, people believe abortion should be legal, but they also still have these feelings that making abortion a little hard to get is not so bad. You know, that abortion should not just be a decision that a woman makes on her own. So that we know that women, like in many states, they support laws like, 3-day waiting periods, mandated kinds of speeches that doctors have to give, even though those speeches are inaccurate, parental consent for minors, all of these things are seen by what's called the mushy middle, the squeamish people in the middle who go both ways, as kind of ways that we compensate for abortion should be legal, but, you know, it's not really a good thing. And so all of these laws that folks who are opposed to abortion put forward, which, as you say, if they put forward a straight up or down agenda, they would lose. But because they play to the ambiguity that a large segment of the population feels, and in states like Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, where you really don't have strong majority support for legal abortion, they have a good base. They have a base plus the middle.
Well, one of the ironies, though, about America, Francis Kissling, is that the red states are in many ways subsidized by the blue states. The red states, like California and New York, pay more taxes and get less back from the federal government, whereas the states in the South, and particularly Louisiana and Mississippi, get a lot more money from the federal government than they give in terms of taxes. And all the statistics indicate that in terms of real family values, the red states are falling behind their blue states in terms of first nutrition. Divorce rates are higher in these states.
Maternal mortality is higher in those states.
Teen pregnancy, incest, you name it. So, when you start hearing about this stuff, and the idea that all these young women have to drive hundreds of miles to blue states to get an abortion, it makes you wonder whether or not, you know, maybe secession isn't such a bad idea. I mean, I guess, I know we've had a civil war over it. It's not something you can say lightly. But my sense is if you guys are going to be a bunch of freeloaders and impose your morality on the country, then why don't you just do it on your own and leave us alone and, you know, we're sick of subsidizing.
And not use our tax money, which you're obviously using in ways that are ineffective anyway, since you can't save babies' lives, you know, in birth. You can't educate children. You don't seem to be able to educate children. You don't seem to be able to provide, you know, low-income families with enough to eat. I mean, it is appalling.
Well, Francis Kissling, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, Ian, thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with feminist activist Frances Kissling, who is the president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007. She is now on the faculty of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. She's a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, where she works on reproductive health in Latin America. And she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for ReligionDispatches.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.